It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today we're looking back at some of our favorite author interviews from 2014. Before Elizabeth Gilbert wrote her best-selling memoir, Eat, Pray, Love, she was known for novels about travel, adventure, and characters that defy convention. Elizabeth came to town for the Pittsburgh Arts and Lecture Monday Night Speaker Series in November to talk about her latest novel, The Signature of All Things, and her return to fictional storytelling. After the success of Eat, Pray, Love, and Committed, she talked about what prompted her to return to writing novels.
It felt like a homecoming to me because it's where I got my start as a writer, even though I think people probably mostly don't know that, nor must they. It's nobody's job to keep track of my resume except mine. But it had been 12 years since I wrote a novel, and I think part of me was a bit afraid that maybe I'd forgotten how to do it. And I wanted to aim high. I felt like I kind of have nothing to lose. So I wanted to write the kind of novel that I love to read, which would be, in this case, a big, expansive, history-based historical novel with a strong female character and a lot of scientific information in it.
And I want to get into some of the particulars of the story. But yeah. When you mentioned having this feeling of nothing to lose, it reminded me of a story that I read in researching for this interview in the New York Times about how you had met Bob Guccione, who's a legend to people of a certain age, who was the publisher of Esquire. Or editor, I guess, would be his exact title. And you met him apparently at a party and then went in to go see him, assuming that he remembered having meeting you. And this sort of led to the start of your professional writing career. I want to let you pick up the story from there because this is just – this is great.
Well, it was actually – it's Spin magazine he was – yeah. But he – I had a friend who was an intern there during college, and I went to a Christmas party, and I talked to him for about 5 minutes. And I guess it was probably 3 years later, 4 years later, I was in New York, unemployed, wanting to be a writer. And I thought, who do I know? Oh, I know that guy, Bob Guccione, the editor. You know, I don't know. You don't know somebody that you shook hands with at a party. But I thought, that's the tenuous thread of connection that I have. And I thought, I have nothing to lose. He doesn't know me. I can't shame myself in front of people who don't even know who I am. You know, so I went over to the offices of Spin and talked my way through a phalanx of three different personal assistants and secretaries until I got into his office and managed to remind him of me. And he gave me a job for 3 days as a assistant secretary because his secretary was going out of town. And I was terrible at it, but I kept saying to him, Bob, I'm a writer. You should read my work. I'm a writer. And he. And at the end of the 3 days, he gave me some cash and said, thank you. It's been nice knowing you. And 6 months after that, Esquire magazine published one of my stories. And I sent it to Bob with a note saying, see, I told you I was a writer. You should have hired me then. And he hired me now. And I ended up working at Spin for 3 years. So I don't know, like there's that expression that fortune favors the bold. And I think from an early age, I just thought nobody's ever going to come and knock on my door and say, we understand there's a very talented young writer living here. So I'm going to have to be the one to go knock on theirs.
And you did.
And I do still.
So let that be a lesson to you aspiring writers. Many of your books reflect a range of experiences, expertise, and travel. And in the novel, Stern Men, you managed to weave insight on the male-dominated world of lobster fishing into the story of a smart young woman living on an island in Maine. And it's written in a way that holds the reader's attention. And in The Signature of All Things, you tell the story of Alma and her 19th century botanist family with real medicinal and botanical research from the time period. Talk about the research you did and how you channeled it into the development of a story like this.
I did about 3 years of research for The Signature of All Things and everything from 18th and 19th century botanical commerce to abolition to the pharmaceutical trade in America to missionary life in the South Seas. There's a part of the book that takes place in Tahiti to the history of whaling ships. You know, I cast a wide net because the story takes place over a century and a half and over the entire world, really. There's almost like nothing I didn't need to know. But the great thing is that that's my tremendous pleasure. You know, I if I could – be – if I could have any other career than the one I had, I would probably be a librarian. people say, wow, you had to do so much research for this book. And I think, no, I got to. I was allowed to spend 3 years with my face in these dusty old volumes recreating 18th century Philadelphia. I can't think of anything I'd rather do with my time.
And during the years of research, I understand that you filled five shoeboxes full of index cards. Explain the system you employed here and how you came up with it.
Well, actually, that system was taught to me in 1984 by my ninth grade social studies teacher, Mr. Kisco, who I thank for the rest of my life because I've used it ever since. He taught us the system of index card note-taking for research papers, and it's so satisfying because it's very tactile. There's also something that's nice about watching those boxes fill, you know, as you're doing your research and seeing those index cards fill up with information. And you can shuffle them around and keep track of stuff in a way that I've just have never found a rival for a better way to do research than that. There's a danger, of course, that your house will burn down and your index cards will go up in smoke, which keeps me awake at night when I'm about to begin writing. But other than that, it's a fail-proof system.
Yeah. Most people, you know, today would do that on a – I mean, and you did do this in a modern-day setting, but you took a sort of a an older approach that an author 100 years ago might use. You didn't do this through computers and files that way.
I'm not a Luddite. I actually am very much in a computerized world and can't live for 2 minutes without my iPhone like the rest of us. But
I saw that.
you saw my panic when I thought I lost it. My soul has gone missing. How will I live? But I haven't found a system that works better than this because you can't take notes off a computer and spread them over the floor of your living room and organize them into piles and see which chapter has more information than others. There's just something about the physicality of the index cards that still works better than anything else.
Talk about the character of Alma Whitaker, whose life is detailed in The Signature of All Things.
So Alma Whitaker is a fictitious character, but she's based on the approximation of several 19th century female botanists in real life whose lives that I studied. Botany was the only scientific trade that a woman could almost sort of practice in the 19th century, almost to the level that a man could, because plants have always been associated with femininity, so it wasn't considered untoward for a woman to be involved in that world. And some of those women made remarkable scientific contributions and were seen by their male peers as being respectable, as being important. They had papers published. They engaged in academic arguments. And so it wasn't an impossibility to imagine a young woman who would grow up in a family of, in this case, pharmaceutical plant importers and who would become a botanist in her own right and a quite good one at that.
I read that to capture her speech, you spent a year reading almost nothing after 1890.
Yeah. Well, that's not hard for me because that's where I like to read anyway. All of my favorite books are the great 19th century British novels especially. So I was – you know, I got to go back and read all my Dickens and Eliot and Trollope and Austen again, which is not an arduous task. But mostly what I got – where I found her speech was in letters because – and letters of normal people, not necessarily letters of famous people. Letters is – that's where you can hear people's real speech patterns. There's something so informal and especially in the 19th century where people wrote letters the way you and I write email, where they wrote 20, 30 a day sometimes, especially if they lived in a major city and they had three mail deliveries. So you'd be engaged in a conversation with somebody across town and people didn't have time to filter. And so the letters are really raw and you can hear people's emotions. You can hear their anger. You can hear their petulance. You can hear the way that they probably spoke. And I think that's the closest you can get to eavesdropping on a 19th century conversation.
In The Signature of All Things, the plot takes on many dimensions for Alma and her family. Talk about what inspired the different paths you took with the story.
Well, it started because I wanted to write a gardening novel, which sounds as exciting when I say
it
now.
Well, you are a gardener.
Yeah, I am. And even when I say it now, I still have to laugh at my big effort to write the epic gardening novel. I wanted to write about plants. It's the thing that I was most interested in at that moment. And I feel like you should always try to write the book that you would want to read about the subject that you're most engaged with. And so that was the beginning. And then I had to try to figure out how to possibly make that interesting. And it appears that the most interesting moment in botanical history was that era between the end of the Age of Enlightenment and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, where there was still this sense of amateur scientific discovery, that people were making amazing discoveries in their backyards, in the fields and meadows and woods around them. And I thought I could make an amateur botanist out of this, and she could be female and it could be plausible. And then the book turned into sort of a treatise on evolution, because there's no way to write about any 19th century science without writing about evolution, because that was the big debate that was going on at the time. And that guided the story.
It's relevant to today in some ways, because certainly there's that debate in some way, shape, or form never seems to leave us.
Yeah, it's not over. It's important to remember it's recent. It's still recent. We're still trying to sort that all out.
Talk about the importance of travel to the way that you write.
Well, I'm kind of the I shouldn't say anti. That sounds pejorative. I'm sort of the opposite of Emily Dickinson. I think there are writers who have such incredible fertile imaginations that they never have to leave their bedroom, and they can create universes just with the power of their minds. And I don't have that gift. And for me, the only way I can find stories is to hunt them down like a big game hunter, sort of go out there in the world and try to spear them. and for that, I have to leave my house. I have to leave my bedroom. I've got to go roll around in it and see what things smell like and feel like and talk to people and engage in conversation. And you know, in The Signature of All Things, there's a large portion of the book that takes place in the South Pacific. And so I went to French Polynesia, which again was not a trauma. But it was important to go, because in all the reading that I had done about it, I hadn't realized that the very important beach where most of this story would be taking place has black sand. It's one of those things that nobody ever mentioned, and I wouldn't have known it, and it's kind of important. Like, there's certain things that you have to just go see and find in order to give reality and gravitas to the story.
When did you know? I guess I don't know if you ever really know, but when you were writing as a young person, at what point did it occur to you that, you know, I've got this. I know how to do this, and I love doing it. When it came to writing,
I think I always knew it. We grew up in a house with a lot of books. My parents aren't writers, or they're not professional artists, but they're makers. They're creative people. They're farmers. My mom's a sewer, a cook, a gardener. My dad raised goats and chickens. They were people who had a great deal of entitlement in a weird way. I mean, they're very humble and very earthly people, but they had this sense of entitlement that if there was something that they wanted or were interested in the world, they were allowed to do it, and they were allowed to try to do it themselves, and they didn't ever ask anybody's permission for anything. And I think that's probably the greatest gift that I ever had, was that I felt like I like this thing and I want to do it, and I don't need a permission slip from the principal's office to do it. You're allowed to create for no other reason other than that it brings you to life.
And I read that you, when you were a kid in grade school, that you wrote a play about a girl who has achieved the ability to travel through time, which is something that I think we're all interested in, the concept, the idea of time travel. And you wrote a play. And this was, I guess, your first success as a writer.
Okay, I wrote it. I directed it. I started it. I produced it. And it was a musical. And it was a musical, and it was 15 minutes long. And I forced my entire fifth grade class to watch it. And I cast it. I actually just recently ran into a friend of mine who was in that play. And she said, remember you did that? We did that play. My sister and I were constantly writing plays when we were growing up and putting them on. And she became a young adult novelist, which is not a surprise. But they couldn't stop me. I think they might have wanted to, but they couldn't stop me, unfortunately.
And it was called Mona's Proof.
Mona's Proof, yes. A musical.
And the proof, the whole, I don't want to spoil the ending
for
someone who might see this somewhere, but the proof was finding the proof that she actually had traveled through time, because nobody believed her, and the proof ended up being
a newspaper that she brings back, because you know there's no, that's an airtight alibi right there. There were some holes in the plot, but it more or less held up.
And of course, we want it to be a happy ending. So there you go. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was, you know, after you achieved success as a writer, there were there was the acclaim, and with that for some comes the pressure or what is described as crushing expectations. How did you deal with that, and do you still struggle with just the success that you've had and some of the trappings of that?
Well, first of all, let's be super clear that that is a champagne problem. the very definition that the world is filled with actual real problems, and that is not one of them. And I'm grateful that that is my problem. And the best training I ever had for how to cope with success was learning how to cope with failure, because I had a lot of that before I had success. And the only way to get through it is to put your head down and keep working, regardless of the outcome. And that works kind of in both directions.
That was best-selling author Elizabeth Gilbert sharing her writing experiences with us back in November.